Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Autumn Semester 2014. Lecture 4, delivered on August 27, 2014. The title of this lecture is Financial Institutions.
Today, financial institutions. You can divide up financial institutions in all kinds of ways. What they do, how they're regulated, how big they are. Essentially, there's a problem right now that it's a little harder to describe what a financial institution is, divide them up, than it used to be in the past. As I had mentioned sometime in the last few lectures, there used to be a law, the law was passed in the early 1930s, cracking down on banks doing all kinds of things banks shouldn't do, and putting regulation with teeth into effect. And that law was called Glass-Steagall. And Glass-Steagall served, the Glass-Steagall Act, served to protect consumers and to keep banks in a disciplined behavioral pattern for decades. It ended in 1999. It was repealed. It just went away. And that's when the Wild West came back to the banking sector. Essentially, before in the era of Glass-Steagall, a bank could do some things, but it was not allowed to do other things. Its focus was narrow. Think of it like this. The bank's job is to take people's money, take businesses' money, and put it somewhere safe, invest it in things that were safe, and give a modest but decent interest rate for the money that was in their care, custody, and control. Glass-Steagall made sure that banks behaved themselves. When Glass-Steagall was gone, essentially, the world kind of changed. Now, you would think that there is a regulator of banks in the United States. There is not. There are regulators of banks. Some banks are regulated by the Federal Reserve. Other banks are regulated by the FDIC. Other banks are regulated by the state. Other banks are regulated by other regulatory agencies. It's a crazy quilt, and there is no single regulator of banks. Now, after the crisis of 2008, of course, you had Congress trying to find some way to get things back together, but imagine you say, all right, all banks are going to be regulated now by, let's say, the Federal Reserve. Well, the turf war was just initiated right there. Oh, you're not going to touch our banks, FDIC says. Well, you're not going to bother our banks, the state says. Well, we are going to be the regulator of these banks, some other regulatory agency says. And so no one would give ground. No, we're not going to let someone else regulate the banks we regulate because we're in existence because we regulate these banks. And if you take them away from us and give them to someone else to regulate, we go out of existence. Besides, those regulators suck. Look what they've done. Their banks are the ones that have fallen apart. Ours are doing well. So you got just it was a great idea. Get all banks to be regulated by a single regulatory authority. Ain't gonna happen. Not now, not anytime. So we're still essentially in the same world we were before the crisis of 2008. The regulatory structure is such that different financial institutions are regulated by different animals. And because there is no Glass-Steagall, banks can do a lot of things that are probably not a good idea for banks to do. taking, for example, your money that you deposit and putting it into things that are extraordinarily risky, or talking to you about saving money, but they're also the ones who are buying initial public offerings of stock in companies like Facebook and other ridiculous disasters, and then they are convincing you that your money will be safe with them because we're a bank. We take care of your money. Bullshit. So there's the world you're stepping into. Look, like I said, and the book actually does a decent job of laying out these banks are regulated by this, these banks are regulated by this. I'm not going to hold you to remember what banks are regulated by this. But know the basic structure. Many banks are regulated by, and I'll talk about this one much more in depth. Many banks are regulated by this, by the Federal Reserve, which was set up in the 19-teens to oversee the banking industry. So a lot of banks are under the regulatory authority of the Federal Reserve. But not all banks are under the regulatory authority of the Federal Reserve. Another regulatory body that has control of some banks would be the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Now, other banks are not national banks. They're actually state-chartered banks. So the states, through their banking regulators, regulate those banks. Those are state banks. The states individually regulate the banks that are state banks. They are not under regulatory authority of the federal government at all, although there are laws that might apply to them. And then there are other kinds of banks that have their own. And then there's a completely different authority that regulates credit unions, which are essentially banks in most of their functions and many of their functions. Recently, credit unions have actually been allowing business accounts, which is great for me because now I can have a credit union. I can have my company's banking done through a credit union, which is a very good thing for me. But credit unions have their own regulatory. And then there are these other animals. They're not banks, but they are financial institutions. They come under labels like the savings and loan. Sometimes these are called thrifts. These had a huge scandal, an incredible scandal, befall them in the 1980s, later 1980s. And they lost, a lot of them disappeared. They lost their reputation. So you don't see as very many savings and loans, but they've got their own regulatory body, even though they do a lot of things banks do. And then you have other animals of various kinds. You have community banks. Community banks, as the name implies, try to focus on providing banking services for their communities and also doing most of their loans back into the community. Now, that's different from normal banks. And then there are these older animals. You don't see them much anymore, but interestingly enough, they were strong, and they were so strong that these kinds of banks survived at a much higher rate than other banks in bad times. One such type of bank was what was called the mutual bank. Now, a few of these are still around, and they are sort of like a credit union. Here's how a mutual bank works. They were usually small and in a community or in a cluster of communities, and they would say, all right, you want to deposit money in our bank. You want to become a depositor, have a checking account with us. Okay, but if you do that, what you are actually doing is buying an ownership position in our bank by doing that. So we are going to review you. Are you someone we want to be an owner of this bank? Because everyone who deposits in this bank becomes an owner. And as such, there is this real tight accountability. The bank president walking down the street, He is seeing the owners who hire him, who can fire him every day. The financial decisions, they are done by the owners who are the depositors. So shenanigans are not likely to go on because the owners, their money is going to be the money that's invested. They not only have their checking accounts, but that checking account represents ownership in the bank itself. They own part of it. That's sort of like how credit unions work. And these things were very strong. Like I said, in bad economic times, these things survived at a much higher rate than your typical banks. In fact, as a general rule, small community banks, community-oriented banks, mutual banks, have a much higher track record of success than typical banks throughout the history of banking. Interestingly enough, one of the fascinating stories in this regard has to do with the Great Depression. Banks just were falling apart all over the place. One sector of the banking community that had almost no bank failures was the banking activity that was done in African American communities, because they were all tightly owned, mutual, and community-oriented banks. They didn't collapse. They never failed because the whole economy could go to hell. All the banksters on Wall Street could be having a fit and destroying banks and being the destroyed in banks. But these mutual banks, these community banks like that, they didn't deal with those banksters. They had their own rules. They had their own accountability to right in their community to the people that they were serving. Didn't fail. Hardly ever. As a matter of fact, the horrible story is that in one large city in Kansas, there was a vibrant, incredibly successful African-American community with banks that were highly successful in the era of the Great Depression. And it pissed off the white people so much that they raided the community, killed people, burned the banks to the ground, and wiped out that sector. Just wiped it out because they were so pissed off because those cats were doing things right by not putting their money in the hands of the New York banksters. So there you go. Okay, enough of that. Let me go on to something else here. Let me talk about the Federal Reserve. And over the weekend, I'm going to open up a quiz. It's not a hard one. But I'm also going to have you watch, if you want to, a video that is made by the Federal Reserve. It's a cartoon video, of all things. It's the cheesiest, corniest thing. But it actually covers a lot of what I do in this lecture. And it's probably a little more interesting because the narrator is this cartoon character called Buck. Get it? Buck. A buck for dollar. Never mind. I thought it was lame too, but apparently everyone likes the video. And it actually, like I said, it's made primarily for students in high school, but it's great. Anyone who wants to know about the Federal Reserve, I say first watch this little video. It's like about 10 minutes long, and it's very engaging. So what I'm going to say here follows that video fairly closely. But look, in the 1800s, late 1800s, and I've talked about this before, it was the Wild West in business and all that. And one sector that was a mess was the banking sector. There were banks that were collapsing fast and furious all over the place. There were so many collapses, runs on banks, that they were having macroeconomic impact. It's one thing when one bank falls apart, but when you have a cascading effect of banks falling apart, well, that can actually eventually cause the economy itself to slip into recession, as we have seen, interestingly enough, in recent times. But it was just like a Wild West. It was craziness. There was no protection of consumers, really. It was just if you put your money in a bank, I mean, you're risking everything. There were pyramid schemes all over the place. No one was watching the hen house. Except for a bunch of foxes who kept saying, self-regulation, we can regulate our own industry. No need for government, we'll watch our own. Well, that led to catastrophe after catastrophe, and it got a lot of people pissed off. And also, here's the thing is, when you piss off normal people, who cares? But when you start screwing rich people who are getting sucked up into these collapses, then suddenly the politicians hear from people they care about, the people who have money. And that was what was finally starting to happen, was that meaningful citizens were getting hurt. Families were losing large amounts of, rich families were losing large amounts of money in this banking, just free-for-all, Wild West. So in the second decade of the 20th century, and it was during a narrow window of kind of like liberal politics from in the second decade of the 20th century, the Federal Reserve Act was passed. It created a central bank, a modern invention that was beginning to take hold around the civilized world. In other words, a bank that was sort of like the central mechanism for regulation, for monetary policy, and all of that. And in this case, one of the most important roles of the Federal Reserve, and I'm going to go through three roles, was that it took monetary policy out of the hands of Congress. Now, if you are a senator, madam, and you want to please everybody, wouldn't it be nice if you could just print money and hand it out to everybody? That would be great. That's bad. What happens if you print too much money? Do you remember that from the last lecture? And what do we call that? Bingo. So, I mean, we can't let the Congress do that. We can't trust them to do something like have control of monetary policy. So the Federal Reserve Act created, one of the things it did, among other things, was it created the Federal Reserve System and the Federal Reserve Bank. And then monetary policy, whether you print more money or you claw money out of the economy, all of that was in the hands of an independent body of experts and not in the hands of Congress. It would have been great if we could have done that for fiscal policy as well as monetary policy. In other words, take taxing and spending policy out of the hands of the politicians, but that never happened. But at least monetary policy was taken out of the hands of the politics and put in the hands of technicians, bureaucrats, and experts. That was a big thing. Of course, there was a constitution. To this day, there are all these people who say it's unconstitutional because the Constitution says Congress is in charge of the currency and all that. But one way or the other. So the Federal Reserve System and the Federal Reserve Bank were created. And they were the ones who were given charge of three fundamental duties. Three fundamental duties. The duties of the Fed. First, the first duty of the Fed is to regulate and supervise the banks. Notice that banks here is a general term. As time went on, more and more banks were not under the Fed's control, but it still controls a lot of banks. Okay, here's where I get into this. The Federal Reserve structure is that there are seven governors. They are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. One of those seven is the chairman. Now watch it, because I will ask this either on a quiz and or on an exam. There are seven governors plus one chairman. True or false? False. Somehow I'll ask it, one way or the other. There are seven governors, and one of them is the chairman. sort of like the lead dog, the spokes goat for the whole group. But the seven governors are appointed by the president with the advice and consent of the Senate. These are the cream of the crop of the intellectual, business, banking, finance world. They are, at least historically. In more recent times, we have gotten some absolute losers, quite honestly, on the as governors. Politically sensitive to one party or the other, or just they sound like a great name to put on the Fed. One of the more recent appointees to the Fed was actually, she ran a community bank and drilled it into the ground. It was bought out by Wachovia, which asked her, they gave her a check and said, please leave. And then after that, she was a dinner theater actress for a bunch of years, and now she's a governor of the Federal Reserve. That's how bad it is now. And then you have some which are much stronger, much more intelligent. The current chairman of the Federal, well, let me see what your astuteness is. Who's the chairman of the Federal Reserve now? Don't know? Who?
Janet Yellen.
She is the protege of the last chairman, who was Uncle Ben Bernanke. And before Uncle Ben, we had Alan Greenspan. And before Alan Greenspan, we had Tall Paul Volcker. And before him, we had God knows what you would call those fools. But these guys and women, and one thing that has happened, and thumbs up to this, is that there is at least a little more diversity in the governors now than there used to be. It used to be all old white boys, and they had only one way of seeing anything. And sometimes that's not what you need. When you've got problems that you need innovation and larger perspective, you need a diversity of experience, life, background, and that is coming a little bit more nowadays than it used to. Okay, those are the governors. The country under the Federal Reserve Act was divided into 12 districts. 12 districts. And each of these districts would have its own district bank, which oversaw operations in that district. Unfortunately, at the time this system was created, there were a lot more people on the East Coast than on the West Coast. So you had the districts in the East Coast, real small, dense population. The districts out west were bigger and bigger. Now that's amazing how bad it is, because like San Francisco, that Federal Reserve District Bank manages a large territory and a lot of activity. So it didn't work out quite as good. Now, right here in our part of the country, we are almost right on a borderline between two district banks. There's Chicago and there's St. Louis. We're just north of the line for Chicago. A little farther south, and we'd be in the St. Louis District Bank. I'll tell you some background stories on this in a little bit here. But there are 12 district banks, and each of these district banks each has a district bank president. These people are important not just because they oversee a region of banks, but some of these bank presidents actually participate in an important committee called the Federal Open Market Committee. I'll get to that probably in the next lecture. But here you go. So you have seven governors, and under them, 12 district bank presidents. Now here's the thing. The governors regulate. They take law and make regulations. And then the 12 district banks take those regulations and they supervise the banks in their area. So the governors regulate and the bank presidents supervise. And again, that will be on a quiz and or a test. Okay? The big dogs in the Federal Reserve's big main office, those governors, they make up the rules. And then they say to the bank presidents, here are the rules. Now, go make sure that the banks in your district follow these rules. Now, these district bank presidents are cream of the crop. I've met two in my life. They're just like the consummate everything, perfectly dressed, politically astute, intelligent, just amazing people. I don't think they even have sex. But matter of fact, I'm pretty sure of it. That one guy was ugly as ass. But anyway. So that's the regulate and supervise thing. And you'll see different flavors in these banks. Give you a good example. St. Louis Bank is sort of well known as the education bank. They do all kinds. You go to the St. Louis Fed site, and I'm going to give you the link to it. I think it's actually in the sidebar of my podcasting site. But the Federal Reserve Bank in St. Louis, they have all of these educational materials. They are the ones who created that that video you're going to watch. You can even go there. They've got games kids can play. I mean, that's kind of sad, you know, when your kids can't have an Xbox, you have them go to the Fed site and play Federal Reserve games. Really mess them up bad. Talk about turning some kid emo. Did you hear about the new emo brand pizza? It cuts itself. The hell with you. Anyway, but it's actually, and I go down to the St. Louis Fed. I have a couple of my fellow former students from Ohio State, some others that I've known over the years. They love to have, I took my students down there just last spring, and they welcomed us. They gave us a nice tour. They told us about internships. They offered a couple of people jobs. One of those people turned it down because she's a libertarian. But they're really great down there. You go up to Chicago, and it's like a different world that bank is. I took my students up there about 3 years ago. All I wanted to do was take them in and have them look at the museum because they got a museum with paper money. They show the history of banking. And they acted like we were terrorists trying to destroy their bank. My students were herded into this through this narrow channel to go into the museum. And I was behind them, and the security guard, this big woman, hits me on the knuckles. I didn't say you could go in. Bam. You know, damn, bitch. No, I said that. I mean, and there are students who can attest that's what happened. I mean, you know, what the hell? As it turned out, I kind of liked her. She was big. Anyway, I mean, it was just like a different world. I mean, I was used to the St. Louis Fed where, you know, sure, we'll show you around. We got to be careful with security. You know, we got trained snipers who will kill you if you walk off the path. But they're a lot nicer. Chicago Bank, my God, it was like a different world. They took themselves way too seriously. But the banks and the different banks have different things. For example, there's one Federal Reserve Bank that's more in charge of data, collecting data on business activity. There's one Federal Reserve District Bank that's more in charge of working on the computer systems and innovations in computer design and software. And that takes us to the next point, too. The Federal Reserve serves as a bank for banks. Now, this gets into some interesting political territory that I'll mention here. I mean, you need a bank, don't you? Well, a bank needs a bank, too. I mean, a bank needs a place to deposit its money. Now, it can't do it to itself. So a bank needs a bank. And there are banks that serve this purpose. They're called commercial banks. They will do the banking, the checking accounts, savings account, whatever you want, for banks. The Federal Reserve actively competes against those private commercial banks. They just step into the market as one of the providers. You're a bank. You could actually come to me, the Fed, for your banking services, or you could go to one of these private commercial banks for your banking services. So the Fed enters the market and participates under rules. First rule is the Fed can't price like a predator. It can't just cut its prices down because it's a government agent. It has to compete on a fair ground. Also, the Federal Reserve works all the time on new technology, and anything it does, it must share with the private commercial banks. That's why we have things like swipe a debit card, instantly it's approved. That was Fed technology that it shared, it had to share with all of these other commercial banks, and then the banks that they serve have these services. Check clearing is high speed, incredibly high speed. Those high speed check clearing mechanisms were developed by the Fed, and then it shared it with all of the commercial banks for their bank customers to be able to move their checks through. So the Fed has to provide and share all of its technological innovations, and it's doing that kind of stuff all the time. And finally, the Fed, when it makes a profit off its operations, it has to turn it over to the Treasury. It has to give that money to the government. And in that regard, it gives huge amounts of money every year. Now understand, okay, first of all, this was about 4 or 5 years ago. I'd always taught this. I'd been teaching this for years and years. And someone finally asked me in a class, okay, well, how much of this commercial banking does the Fed have versus the private providers? I had no idea. I mean, so I called up a former fellow student of mine from Ohio State who works down at the St. Louis Fed, and I asked, okay, well, what's the deal? And he said, oh, well, he said it actually is highly different. It's different between the different districts. He said, here in the St. Louis district, I think he said the number was something like, we have about 60% of the banking market. And then private commercial banks have the other 40% among the 4 or 5 big competitors. He said, but, he said, you go to other parts of the country and the Fed might have 30, 40%, and the commercial private banks might have the balance. He said, so it's not really one number. You have to look by region. Now, here's the interesting thing, though, is that what I'm describing here is the Federal Reserve Act created a public option for banks. They could go private and use private services, or they could go public and use the public service. The first thing is that any idea that destroyed the private sector is false. Those commercial banks, private commercial banks, are making huge amounts of money, as is the Fed. Second, the bank fees are extraordinarily low because of the ferocity of the competition. And third, this sounds so much like the debate that was going on in 2009. Why can't we create a public option for health insurance? The private health insurers can offer their policies. The government can offer a policy. Let the people decide which one. That would create such fierce competition that health insurance premiums would fall dramatically. There's no evidence from the banking sector that's been doing this for almost 100 years that it kills the private sector. The private sector in the banking industry is doing great with commercial operations. So, I mean, I was one of the economists who actually brought this up. Why don't we just do health insurance like we do banking, where there's the government offers policies competing directly against the private sector. The government has to share its technological innovations with the private health insurers. And any time that the government's health insurer makes profit, it has to give it back to the government. In other words, it's not going to shareholders or to banksters or something like that. Oh, God, you would have thought that was the stupidest idea in the world. Oh, my God, that's socialism. Well, apparently that has been working for the Federal Reserve. That's probably the biggest success of the three that I'm going to give you. The Bank for Banks is by far, unqualified, the biggest success of the Federal Reserve's three roles. The third role is that the Federal Reserve conducts monetary policy. For decades, the Federal Reserve had one and only one role, or job, I should say, with respect to monetary policy. It was to maintain the stability of the aggregate price level. Maintain the stability of the aggregate price level. In other words, that's a fancy way of saying the only thing the Fed should care about in printing money or clawing money back is to keep inflations and deflations from ever happening. The money supply should grow at the real growth rate of the economy. That's all. Print money as the economy grows. If it grows faster, provide the liquidity. If it grows slower, then drain the liquidity. But that's the only thing monetary policy should do. And that was in effect from the beginning of the Fed until the 1970s, when Congress had the genius to say, well, you know, the Fed, if it prints money, it can make the economy go faster. It can stimulate the economy. And so Congress passed a second objective, which was directly in direct contravention of the first objective. The Federal Reserve should stand ready to help the economy. In other words, never mind not printing too much money. If the economy is in trouble, Fed, you are now by law required to print extra money, which down the road will finally create inflation. So, from then on, the Federal Reserve, actually before that, the Fed had been playing it. But it became official in the 70s and ever since then that when the economy is sagging, the Federal Reserve is expected to print buttloads of money to wake the economy up. And then, before the inflation from that sets in, it's supposed to figure out how to claw that money back out. So in other words, the Fed should add liquidity and drain liquidity based upon economic activity, not based upon the duty to control the inflation rate. So there you go. That's where the Fed stands to this day. Now, a little bit of history, and this is light history. But know this. I told you about how inflation really isn't what we care about. It's expected inflation. Because you see, once you are expecting inflation, it's hard for me to make you stop expecting inflation. You are going to be suspicious. If I've been printing money too fast as a Fed for too long, sooner or later you're going to figure you can't control yourself. You're a crack addict. You're going to just crank out money no matter what you say. So that's what began to happen. Look, we came out of the era of Eisenhower, this boring president who said, not too much on the right, not too much on the left, not a lot of social programs, not a lot of tax cuts for the rich, just keep everything level. And we went into a more activist era of Jack Kennedy. But Jack was killed in Dallas in 63, and Johnson took over. Johnson had two big things that he wanted to do. He wanted the Great Society. We were going to wage a war on poverty. Now, to wage a war on poverty, you got to have money. How are you going to get money? High taxes on the rich, obviously. We had very high taxes back then. Didn't seem to kill jobs at all. But we also printed money. because we had another thing we were doing too. We were fighting the Vietnam War, which was getting more and more expensive, bloody, and not very prospective of any good outcome. So we had a guns and butter fiscal policy. Money for the poor, get them jobs, get them housing, get them food, fight poverty. And we were also going to fight those communists in Southeast Asia because of what we thought was a domino effect. If Vietnam fell, then Cambodia, Laos would fall, and all these other places would go communist. And we wanted to stop it where it was in Vietnam. So we were spending money on butter and guns. Well, that's printing money. We started printing money. We tried to control it, bring the money back, supply back down, but damned if the OPEC oil embargo in 1973 caught us off guard. Oil prices skyrocketed. People were materially poor. They were standing and waiting in lines an hour, 2 hours, 5 hours for gasoline because the Arabs had just cut off our oil supply because they were sick of us just all the time supporting Israel. And so the Federal Reserve, and here's the term that you use. Write this down. The Federal Reserve monetized the price shock. The Federal Reserve monetized the price shock. You see, if all that had happened is that gas prices had gone through the stupid roof, people wouldn't have had money for other things, businesses would have failed, and we would have fallen into a recession. But if the Fed printed money and put it in everyone's pocket, then they would still be able to afford all of the other things and the high gas prices too. That's what it means to monetize a price shock. You're essentially just smoothing out a spike by pouring money into the economy so you don't get a trough in everything else in the economy. Nixon knew that this was creating inflation. So his solution, which has been tried over and over again through history without success, was to slap wage and price controls on. Essentially say, prices cannot rise. That's every now and then, I swear, the economists and the politicians who think that you can stop inflation by just simply saying you're not allowed to raise your prices. That's sort of like I shoot you with a gun and then I say you're not allowed to bleed, therefore you won't die. It doesn't work. So after Nixon, his vice president took over when Nixon resigned, Gerald Ford, inflation was turning kind of nasty. I mean, it just kept going. People knew darn well the Fed was just going to keep printing money, to try to keep this juggernaut going. So Gerald Ford, he created a slogan. He said, "We as a country are going to whip inflation now." Of course, that didn't do a damn thing. Inflation just kept rolling. So Ford lost the election in 1976 to Jimmy Carter. Now, Jimmy Carter was kind of a complex man. He was highly, highly educated, and he knew what was really going on. But he was also a very religious man, and he wanted to try to get the country to stop being so greedy, stop being so acquisitive. He would do his fireside chats in the White House. He turned down the temperature in the White House to the point where people were dying of frostbite. It wasn't that bad. But then he'd do his television chats in this giant sweater with his fireplace roaring, trying to encourage people to stop spending so much. And he also said about inflation, that inflation was at its heart something that was a moral problem. So his first approach to inflation wasn't a technical approach, even though we know that was what was really needed. But he got rid of the whip inflation now slogan, and he said, I want the country to see that inflation is the moral equivalent of war. That's right, meow. Didn't work. That's good, Jimmy, you dumbass peanut farmer. But Carter knew what had to be done. Sooner or later, the Fed was going to have to not just stop printing so much money, it was only going to have to drain that massive liquidity overhang. Now, interest rates are the price of money. Jimmy Carter, in 1979, appointed Paul Volcker as the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Paul Volcker was a tall, cigar-smoking man who didn't give a shit about anyone on earth. He's really a great guy. Now, remember that R sub F, the risk-free rate, which is the base rate on everything, is the real interest rate plus the expected inflation premium? Well, here is the real R sub real, okay? And here is the money supply. Here's the demand for money. Now, by this time, the money supply was out here on planet stupid. Paul Volcker, okay, expected inflation was up here in the stratosphere. We all knew inflation was going to go. Yes.
Same as K, right?
Oh, God, I did it. Thank you. Thank you. I told you I was going to do that. Someone shut her up. I can't stand it. Why do I? Rate R. K, what does that mean? Special K? I don't know. But they use K's in the books. Thank you. Don't get old. Kill yourself before you get to my age. It'll save embarrassment for your kids. Okay. So we had expected inflation was raging. We all knew the Fed was just going to keep printing money and was just going to get worse and worse inflation was. So the expected inflation premium in the base rate, K sub F, was out there in the stratosphere. And then here comes Paul Volcker along. Cue the music from Star Wars. Ba, 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 ba. He cut the money supply back. He brought it back, and he just kept bringing it back and bringing it back. Well, guess what that did to the real interest rate? It sent it into the stratosphere. The supply of money was going down, so guess what was happening to the rental rate of money? It was going through the roof. So you had the expected inflation premium was up there in stupid land. Now the real interest rate was going through the roof. No one believed that Paul Volcker was going to do it. We had heard this over and over again. Whip inflation now, the moral equivalent of war. No one believed Paul Volcker was going to actually do it. But Paul was going to do it. He was just going to hold the patient down on the bed with his hand on the patient's throat until the patient said, okay, you are my daddy. And by God, by the time of the election season of 1980, you had mortgage rates 20-25%, corporate bonds in the 25-30% range. It was only in recent years some of those 30-year bonds actually finally retired. You had interest rates that were in the stratosphere. The economy was essentially, we had inflation, we had a stagnated economy, we had something called stagflation. Stagflation. It's sort of like a stag party without the fun. Stagflation. In other words, inflation was raging because everyone expected it. I'm going to jack up my prices tomorrow. And they didn't realize that Volcker was serious. And so going into the election of 1980, you had Jimmy Carter. He was the architect, and everyone blamed that poor son of a bitch. He was up there, my name is Jimmy Carter, please don't kick my ass. And against him was Ronald Reagan. Simple, old home folksy Ronald Reagan, former governor of California, Western, was an actor in Western movies and a star in cigarette commercials. Well, you know, if I'm president, I'll kick that son of a bitch out of the White House. And of course, everyone, they kicked Carter out. They kicked him out. He lost the election hard because people said, God, look at the interest rates. Are you out of your mind? We're not going to put you. So then, of course, as Volcker held the money supply down over the next many months, finally, business said, oh, I'll be darned. This guy is serious. And so this began to drop. And Volcker held the money supply in strict control, and there were tax cuts passed to try to wake up the economy and some other stuff. We got involved in some nice little secret military kinds of skirmishes to boost things up. But eventually, the economy began to get back in line again, and Volcker could then begin to allow the money supply to grow at the real growth rate of the economy. So over the next couple of years, interest rates, the real interest rate began to decline, expected inflation began to decline, and so this finally began to come back down, and the economy recovered. That is the story of the Fed was involved in this to the extent of getting the mess cleaned up. Now, here's where we are now. The Federal Reserve has been shoveling money into the economy since the crash of 2008. Much of that money was being funneled through the very largest banks in the United States, actually in the world. To outside financial analysts like me, these huge banks were dying. Their financial statements showed them to be on their deathbed. We were recommending shorting these banks. We were saying, don't invest in these. And if these banks fail, the economy is going to collapse and all that kind of stuff. What we did not know was that there was a secret program that the Federal Reserve was shoveling money to these banks. It had started in 2007. It was desperation. And it was a secret program. The financial statements of these banks were not showing this money that was being brought in the back door. The expectation was that this money was going to be used by the banks to flow into the economy. The banks weren't doing that, though. But nevertheless, in 2010, in a rather routine Freedom of Information Act filing, a news organization got some emails that clearly showed that this program was happening. They were about to disclose it in a major article, and not only did the banks, but the Federal Reserve and the Treasury fight them in front of a federal judge saying, we can't let this program be disclosed. In 2010, that amount of money that had been shoveled, printed by the Fed, and put in the back door to these large banks was about $7.7 trillion. That's right, $1 trillion. That's why these banks didn't collapse like we financial analysts thought they would. And that's why the stock market began to recover as rapidly as it did. The banks were just putting the money into the stock market. So in other words, it wasn't creating full-blown real-life inflation. It was creating equity inflation. Stock prices going up purely by inflation. The federal judge ordered did not allow injunctive relief to the banks. She sided with the news organization, and the program was disclosed. It is still running to this day, and it is still not showing on the books of the banks all this money that's being printed. It now is in excess, as of this year, maybe about $15 trillion in printed money that is far, far, that growth rate of the money supply is far, far in excess of the real growth rate of the economy. event, and what's been happening is it's simply showing up in high stock, in rapidly accelerating stock prices. The stock market is rising purely on the money that is being shoveled into the banks, and the banks can use it in the stock market because there's no Glass-Steagall to stop them from doing whatever the hell they want with it. And so, at this point in the history of the country, we have a liquidity overhang, probably on the range of $14 trillion, and sooner or later, that will spill out from the stocks. They'll begin to slide back down, and that inflation will begin to flow out into the economy in an incredibly rapid way once it starts. And then we'll be back to it will be just like 1979 all over again. That's all I have for you today. Go home.